So tonight, obviously English is the language that always we have to clarify first. I'm positive everyone is familiar and at ease with this language. And I thought to reflect a little bit further to what I suggested in the short guided meditation, in the giving attention to the fact that things end from the in the microcosmic realm, but also in the macrocosmic realm. We all know that, of course, intellectually, things have a beginning and an end, but in the Buddhist teaching and in our life, of course, it has a particular significance to not only be focused and oriented towards the new beginnings, so that which excites the mind, arouses our interest, or makes us, you know, looking forward to the future and so forth. This is, of course, a very strong tendency human beings have to always be looking what's ahead of us and what could be improved or what could be better, what is lying ahead of us, the endless possibilities, you know, limitless possibilities lie ahead in the future. We can imagine all sorts of things, what could happen for us, and people have more positive inclination. They imagine wonderful things to happen, positive things to happen. People are a little bit more negatively inclined. They fear, they're afraid of the future, they dread what might be coming, what might be lurking around the next corner, what will the next encounter with another person, or what will the next situation bring at work, or whatever someone is involved in. And so it doesn't really matter so much what it is, because what the person is coming from and reacting from is a kind of very fundamental disposition of the heart, of the mind, more towards the dread and anticipation in a negative way of the future, while others are more looking at it in a more positive way. Well, whatever, as the saying goes, the future is unknown. We don't know what it holds. And so tonight also, I don't want to focus so much upon that which the future holds, or the new births, so forth, in connection with our life. Birth is always that, and also in the Buddhist context, that which stands at the beginning of a cycle of samsaric existence. Without birth, there will not be anything taking place. Huh? Without birth, without something coming into being, something arising, something having a beginning, then of course there will be not a middle and there will not be an end. It sounds a bit like a truism, doesn't it? It's quite self-evident, but when we're looking a bit closer at our mental, emotional experience, then we can see it does have a significance. Okay. The births and deaths we experience in our life, the little births and deaths we experience in our life, are very important to have a closer look at. And of course also the part in the middle, what's taking place between the birth and death. And in this context, of course we're using contemplative practices, we're using meditations to have a closer look at our experience. And you're using reflective forms of meditation, or contemplation maybe they should be called, like what we did this morning. We do these reflections, these morning reflections regularly, where we're looking at these five frequent subjects to be contemplated again and again, possibly, ideally, regularly, and possibly also not mechanically, but always in a fresh and new way, if we can. That's how I understand the idea behind such suggestions as we have in the Buddhist tradition. And so when I think an uninitiated person, someone who is not very familiar to maybe the what the Buddhist teachings are about, the first three might sound a bit kind of morbid almost, or depressing. I am of the nature to age. I have not gone beyond aging. I am of the nature to sicken. I have not gone beyond sickness. I am of the nature to die. I have not gone beyond dying. What's that supposed to do with that, for us? Is that why should we, look at those things? These things certainly have to do with ending. When we get sick, that's the ending of the temporary state of health. And as we all know, the state of health we experience sometimes are of a temporary nature. Even if we call ourselves to be someone who is equipped with good health, even that is temporary and eventually will change. So in a way, this reflection prepares us for this fact of life, that we cannot rely on the physical side of our experience as to just, continue smoothly forever and ever and ever, because it's not in the nature of physical bodies to be healthy and well forever and ever and ever. It will change at one point, at least, in our lives. And for some of us, it has actually happened quite a few times that we've been dealing with various forms of sickness. And so those things, of course, most people, they would like to end. We would like to sickness to end very quickly. That is something, of course, we all we contemplate very happily. I want sickness to end quite quickly, a toothache to end. We're very pleased if that happens very quickly. We want an unpleasant weather patch to end also. That's experience. An ending is experience of something pleasant. We want unpleasant guests of our dinner party, who can't find an end with their babbling away. We want them to go home. And when they do, we find that ending very pleasant and pleasing. But, of course, the ending which are more challenging for us are the ending which are challenging what we could call our psychological self, the identification we take with our experience, with this body and this mind. And that's why we have these reflections, because they're pointing right to the very core areas of our human experience where we're very identified. The human body ending is not a problem actually in itself. The body doesn't have a problem to end. The leg doesn't have a problem when it comes to the end of its life, or the arm or the head or the inner organs. They don't really, in themselves, don't have a problem to end. They just stop functioning. They just stop. They just give up what they've been doing out of, because of natural laws, they kick into play, and then the heart stops beating and the blood flow stops being circulated and so forth, and the brain waves don't operate anymore, and then that's what we call death, and this body has died, has come to an end. And the body itself, that's absolutely no issue. The body doesn't say I'm happy about it or I'm unhappy. It's just nature taking its course. But there's someone else who has comments to make about that, isn't it? And this is we usually have comments to make when things go in a way where we feel challenged, where we feel maybe threatened, where we have downright fear or panic when things arise which threaten our well-being or maybe even threatening our life. And the Buddhist teaching is very often a teaching which goes a little bit against the grain of things, against the grain of habit, how we think, how we feel about things. And that's why we are encouraged to look at areas of our experience which normally the average person wouldn't really care to look, unless forced to, unless one has to because one doesn't have any other choice. But who likes to contemplate, you know, these three topics I just mentioned, these daily reflections? Who likes to come in? Just have a seat. Who likes to contemplate endings in general, endings of the body, for example? And this is, of course, when our minds can react very strongly. We can get into either a strategy of denial that we don't want to see. We can fall into a strategy of trying to divert our attention, to distract ourselves. A whole life can be spent in strategies of distracting. Whenever something challenging appears, we have various means to occupy our minds with, occupy our attention with. And we don't notice an underlying sense of dis-ease, of being ill at ease, of maybe even a quiet voice saying, well, it might be actually worthwhile to look at that. Look at, you know, how you, for example, relate to your own body when you notice that your body is getting older and aging. How do you deal with that? What is your attitude towards that? Are you dismissing it, maybe making funny comments all the time about it, but not really letting it close to your heart? Or are you trying desperately to stay fit and healthy? You know, you go to the fitness center 3 times a week and you do jogging and swimming and whatnot as much as you can to stay on top of things. And, of course, there's nothing wrong with looking after the body and keeping it in relatively good shape. But it all depends what is driving us, doesn't it? Can come from completely different driving forces within ourselves. It can be from a very, you know, sober acknowledgement. Yes, it's good to, you know, give this machine some attention so it can function smoothly. But it can also come from a kind of a neurotic fear or dread. You know, if I don't do this, you know, this thing might stop functioning, might stop giving me the gratification which I so much wish for and want to maintain as long as I can. And so here in this context, and when we're contemplating it from the Dhamma side, from the point of view of the truth, of reality, we're looking actually at reality squarely. We're not trying to pretend that reality is actually different than what it is. These bodies are aging, these bodies are getting sick occasionally, these bodies are going to cease and they're going to end and die. And what is our attitude? What is our comment? What is our inner dialogue? What is the story we tell ourselves when we come face to face with these facts of life? And the aspect of separation, which is also mentioned in this daily reflection, or what we love, what is pleasing to us, and we appreciate, and will eventually be separated from us. And of course, you can take this to mean something externally. It can mean the people we love and we like. We feel close to our relatives and friends and spouses and partners and children and grannies and granddads and so forth. But also you can take this in direct application to yourself. You have to say goodbye to these wonderful mental emotional habits you have developed in this lifetime. And some of them you might be quite happily wanting to say goodbye to. You know, maybe you wish to say goodbye to your inner tyrant, that voice in you which keeps making bad comments about almost anything you do or parts of the things you do. I talked to a lady today after lunch who's must be my age, and she's retired, so she must be in her early 60s. And she was speaking about that she's had this all her life from childhood onwards. And she knew from where it was coming from, that this was created in her family situation, that these voices, actually she could remember that they came, a lot of these voices were coming from, especially from her parents. They wouldn't see anything good in her and just kind of putting her down right wrong from an early age. And that's, of course, a very difficult task to come out of that habit, because eventually you will internalize that the parents might not be alive any longer. They might not be with us anymore. But then you start to do it, or we start to do it to ourselves. We have internalized the voices which we've been receiving when we were young and helpless and didn't have any other choice. What does a child do who's told that he or she is no good, or that anything you tackle, you do, is of not much value? Well, you will try to find value, won't you? Because to try to find value is a very basic human need. We all have this need for value, to be evaluated, especially as kids, of course, that is very necessary. If children are not evaluated for who they are, not because they are good girls or good boys and do everything right, but intrinsically for who they are as a human being, then something goes really off. Something goes really off center. And then, of course, the children will try to do anything they can to get this from outside. Other people, other human beings, then have to provide this. And if they're lucky, actually, one should say, then there are maybe beings who provide it for them. But this will not solve, of course, the issue of in feeling inside, intrinsic feeling inside, that something is badly wrong about me, something hasn't gone right, or something is... will probably, and then of course the projection is into the future, this can never be resolved. Very often people also have voices like that, like this woman had today. This will never end. Even she was doing psychotherapy and looking at it with a therapist for a few years. She actually said, this is probably never going to end. Well, if we believe such thoughts, then it will never end. But in Buddhism, the good news about Buddhism is it tells us that everything will end at some point. Even those things will end. Unless you're turning it into a self-fulfilling prophecy, this will never end, I'm sure, I'm convinced. These inner voices, I've heard them all my life, they will never go away. I have to live with this pain for the rest of my life. Then that's it. You've confirmed it, you've given it final stamp of approval, and then of course that's what's going to happen. But if you can bring in at least a little bit of a doubt, a little gap there, and this is what meditation is good for, say, stop it. Do I really have to believe that thought? Is this really the only comment I can make to something of that significance, of that importance? Say, this issue of self-worth, of value. Or can I maybe just stop for a moment? Well, in meditation, we're not only stopping for a moment, we're trying to stop for many moments. We're trying to create gaps. So we were saying earlier, the gaps in our life are very important. We make occasionally the experience of stillness, of quietness, when all this mental commentary, all this stuff which we've been churning up our lifetime can actually cease, can come to an end. And if it is, of course, of such an unpleasant nature, then we will feel a great sense of relief. We will feel, oh, I wouldn't have thought this was possible. I thought this is who I am. I am this person who has this very solid conditioning of being a person who is of not much value. And then we can see, maybe for the first time in our lives, we can see it ourselves. And this is the only person who can really help there. Our therapist might tell us, well, you know, you are a worthy person. You know, you just stop doing these negative things. But it still, it won't help unless we see it. We see what we are recreating, this pattern within ourselves. We don't allow this pattern to come to an end. We don't allow this inner voice to cease and recognize this is only a condition of mind. And because it has been happening in such regularity and such quick succession, we taking this as an assumption, we assume that really belongs to us. This is who we are. But in the Dharma, in the Buddhist teaching, we're saying, no, definitely, you are not who you think you are. You're not your conditioning. You're neither the whole conditioning process, neither are you any particular aspect of the conditioning process. But it's a good idea to investigate your own conditioning process, because of a lot of the conditioning we have been undergoing, and we've kind of internalized in lifetime, is actually not very helpful for us. And this is what in Buddhism, or the Buddha called the me-making, the I-making, or you could also call it the self-making process. We are constantly creating and recreating a particular image of ourselves when we engaging in this inner dialogue. And when we're not attending carefully, when we're not having any spaciousness, any mindfulness, any awareness around these issues, then these commentaries will follow just the established pattern, the established status quo, just to be in a reconfirmation. But when we allow things first, of course, to come to an end, we allow to gaps to rise in the mind and then to investigate, does it have to be that way? Is this who really who I am? Is this really what makes me, gives me an essential self-worth? And we can only say, no, this is definitely not who we are. In fact, we can more find who we are if we're attending to the gaps, if we're attending to the stillness and to the silence and connect with that and can abide in that and rest in that. That is actually much more who we are than any of the commentary, any of the objects floating through, any of the activities which we create mentally, emotionally. These are usually going according to conditioning processes. And to some extent, of course, also we're not only doing that, attending quietly to the stillness, to the gaps, the spaciousness of the mind, but at the same time, or you could say in addition, we also creating wholesome new tendencies. And that's also something which is made a lot of in the Buddhist teaching. We're not just helpless victims of the bad habits we have, the negative impulses, the angry voices, the fearful voices which we experience, but we can counterbalance them and create wholesome impulses. We can remind ourselves that there are teachings about treating ourselves in particular with loving kindness, with compassion, and develop a sense of equanimity towards our experience rather than getting aroused by any which emotion, feeling, or thought which floats through our mind. And this can only be done, of course, especially equanimity can only be developed if we have a regular mode within the course of a day to attend to things carefully, attentively, mindfully, and try to explore, is there actually another refuge in our life? Not just as an ideal, the Buddha Dhamma Sangha refuge as an ideal, which we put on the shrine, symbolized by certain things which we bow to regularly. That's fine and good to do too, and we do this here, of course, on a daily level too. But we of course try to take these things more directly into our experience. What do these symbols, what do the refuges actually mean, if we take them to heart, using in a way that they actually become a refuge where we always, after a while, automatically we orient towards them. Whenever life goes rough, we're having a hard time, or again, we are acknowledging these unpleasant visitors in our consciousness, we can stop and say, okay, no, this is not my refuge. My refuge is more the spaciousness, the silence, the awareness, the stillness. And then I attend from there. I can see, oh, there is it again. Okay. I've seen it so many times, and sometimes I get disheartened because I've looked at it so many times. But I will not give up. I will not give in. I will not make any extra commentary. I will not engage in self-fulfilling prophecies according to, you know, that my fear pattern or anger pattern will exist forever and ever and ever. Because I know through my own experience that things can change. Even deep-seated patterns, emotional, mental patterns, can actually change. We're not bound to endure them to the day we die. They can actually end before we die. And that was, of course, that's of course what we all definitely wish for, don't we? We wish to free the mind as much as we can, as much as we're able to, before we actually physically die. When we're in our deathbed and we have not much energy left and so forth, and hopefully we've met some preparations so that we can actually let go and, you know, move into the unknown. The big unknown, which is supposed to come after what we call physical death. But some of you must have heard this famous saying. I think it's from the Zen tradition. If you're able to die before you die, then you won't die when you die. Wonderful paradox, isn't it? But what it means, of course, is if we can die to the ego self, to the little self, you could say, to the selfishness within ourselves, to the psychological self, if we can die to that within this life, then, of course, we won't die when we physically die. Because then there's no problem, isn't it? Then things will just take their natural course. As I said initially, the body itself won't have a problem with stopping its functioning. But if we're still invested with the ego self, with the psychological self in our physical body, then of course we will suffer. We will not be able to let go. And so we try to let go already before this happens. The challenge is before we actually getting, you know, severe sicknesses or fall, we try to focus on the things we have right now, you know, the little challenges, the little sicknesses, even a toothache or a flu or a cold can be ever so challenging, can't it? If we're in the middle of it, sometimes we feel, oh, this is never going to get better. When is it ever going to stop? We know these thoughts are silly, but we still have them, don't we? And these are, you know, the arenas where we can give attention, that we don't get pummeled around by these little challenges in our lives, but we have a perspective on it. And we can take things more with equanimity and give them the space they need to pass, to go away, to cease, to come to an end. And the coming to an end, of course, this is a very famous formula in Buddhism. The cessation of suffering actually is what is described as the third aspect in the Four Noble Truths. We have the acknowledgement that we have some unsatisfaction in our lives. If we can't acknowledge that, then we have a really bad start. we can't acknowledge that there is, at least at times, every second Thursday or so, a sense of dissatisfaction, a little bit, now and then in our hearts, then we're having problems, because then we're probably living in denial or in the hope that we can bend things and manipulate things in our life, that everything will be honky-dory after all. But it won't. Because it's when it's based on the ego self, the psychological self, and there will be no end to it. There will be maneuvering and manipulating and desperately trying to get what we want, to have our wishes fulfilled, to be happy ever after in the sensual realm and so forth. But these expectations are illusory. They cannot truly bring us the satisfaction which our heart at its deepest level is yearning for. And on the deepest level, of course, the heart yearns for reliable peace, reliable happiness and satisfaction. And that is not, of course, limited, cannot be limited to the sense world, the external world, to our relationships, and of course to the things we're having to do with our own individual experience, with our physical bodies, with our minds, and our feelings and emotions. It has to go beyond that. The refuge the Buddha is pointing to is the refuge we can find in the heart. And the heart, in this respect, is the heart of awareness, the heart of truth, the heart where we can come to rest. And we can come to rest already now, even in this very evening. Maybe not come to rest for good or forever and ever, but we can get a taste for it, a glimpse of it, what it actually means. When we put things down, when we stop the struggle, we give up the resistance and we let things go, we let things cease. And that's when things come to an end, isn't it? When we're giving up the struggle, we're not resisting anymore, and particularly those experiences which we don't like, then things can come to an end, they can cease. And these are the small cessations, you could say, the small liberations of daily life, but they open up a possibility, a very real possibility, that this can also happen more in a large scale of things. That eventually our heart gets more and more trained in this modus. It's a new modus operandum, you could say. It's more trained in a modus operandum of letting go, of letting things cease, rather than hanging on and clutching and investing a lot of attachments into the world of the senses and in the world of our thoughts and feelings and emotions. And so it's very much going contrary to what most people are doing with their lives, isn't it? If we're looking outside and looking how most people live, then we can see they're investing their happiness in very superficial things, very unreliable things, things which are not of very long durations. Speaking about material objects, very obvious, isn't it? How satisfactory is the new gadget which you buy in a shop, the new electronic device, for example, or the new car, or the new this or that, the new dress, the new wonderful piece of art, or whatever. It only gives us a satisfaction for a short while, and then comes the next. And the next, and the next. But as people who are interested in the spiritual dimension, of course, the focus changes. And I think all of us here in this room have got a sense of that. And then we might be looking within ourselves. And then initially, at least, we're trying to find, as quick as possible, a sense of satisfaction within ourselves. And if we're not careful, if this driving force of bhava, of becoming, wanting to become something else in the future, and that can be, of course, in relation to a state of mind, we want to experience a certain state of mind in our meditation. We want to have an experience which is an experience of peace, of calm, of relaxation, of bliss maybe even, of radiant mind, of blissful mind. You know, we can read books about where these promises are described in great detail and held in front of us. And if you're not careful, then we're driven, when what we've been seeking in the material realm, then we're looking for in the immaterial realm, in the realm of the heart and the mind. We're trying to find some other state, some other feeling than we're having now. But this is still becoming. We still want to have something else in projected into the future. We haven't come to terms with the other side of the spectrum. Letting things end, letting things cease. Letting this whole driving force of becoming cease. And that can be done. That is not illusory. It's not beyond our abilities. It just affords a little bit of a different perspective, a little shift of our attention, rather than always towards more, 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 becoming, becoming, becoming. Look towards the other side. What is the experience internally if you let things end? Let things come to a full end. And, you know, like the experience of a breath can be gives a first inkling. If we really attend to the breath and let it fully end, it feels very good, doesn't it? It's very relaxing. You arrive at a deep sense of relaxation. So bringing this into any internal struggle, any resistance, anything we're kind of rubbing against, letting it end, letting it cease. And what is your experience when that happens? There might be maybe a few moments, could be different things, couldn't it? A few moments of disorientation. So now what? Is this it? Am I enlightened? Am I awakened? Is this the emptiness they're always talking about? Or what? And you see, the mind is very quick to interfere with anything, really, any state of mind. If you're not careful, the inner voice comes, the inner commentator comes, and has something to tell us, something to add to the experience. But if we can even let that cease, even let the commentator cease, the one inside who has always something to add to any experience we make, a comment to make, either to disvalue our experience or to suggest we should go for more intensity, more deeper, higher, more elated, more evolved, more spiritual, and so forth. Then, of course, we have lost the track again. So, in fact, actually, to focus on this aspect of cessation, of letting things be, letting things cease, letting them come to a natural end, that can open us. It can open us for a completely new reality. A reality which is not so informed by the habit patterns of our minds, our conditioning, which goes way back, but is reconfirmed in the ignorant mind every day. We reconfirm it. If we're not attentive, we'll just reestablish the same old patterns. And so to get out of that conundrum, it's very good to be attentive, to be as aware as we can. And that's why we're doing these practices of developing mental calm and stillness and developing awareness and mindfulness. So this becomes actually an experienced reality rather than just nice talk and wishful thinking. Each and every one of us has to confirm that. You know, we can not rely on external sources forever. We can rely on books and teachers and teachings and so forth up to a certain point, but then really we have to get down to business. And where the rubber hits the road, so to speak, is always the next moment and the way we attend to the next moment. That's it. That's where it counts. That's when we're asked to be present and attend to it with conscious awareness. So, much more could be said on this theme, but I thought to leave you with these thoughts and encourage you to ponder them further and maybe find a way of also integrating it into your daily life. Of course, this is not limited to calmly sitting here in this nice meditation hall, but it has to go into nitty-gritty of your daily life if it is to be of some value to you. Otherwise, you might as well forget about it. So thank you very much for listening.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.